When you wonder, you're learning. Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids by Greg Bear and Ryan Rydzowski, forward by Joanne Rogers. Chapter 1, When You Wonder, You're Learning, Curiosity. Even by the standards of this particular neighborhood, where a tiger lives in a clock, polka dots litter the streets, and a trolley travels from another dimension, it's an admittedly curious scene. King Friday the 13th, the long-suffering sire of make-believe, is furious. He's just been pranked by two purple pandas, creatures who speak in robotic tones and flaunt their simple superpower. The pandas can appear and disappear with a snap of their fingers. Identical, except for their height, the pandas use their power to trick the tortured ruler, causing Friday to confuse the taller panda for the shorter one, if only for a moment. Of course, in the puppets, a harmless stunt like this, one would fail to inspire outrage. But King Friday the 13th is not most puppets. I don't like being fooled like that, he declares, projecting as much anger as his puppet master can muster. King Friday isn't a villain exactly. He's a reactionary and someone inept, but he tends to give wickedness a wide berth. He's a musician, a poet, and a former pole vaulter, a true Renaissance king, and he's even been known to show kindness. Once, upon meeting a starving magician, he established the King Friday Queen Sarah Saturday Royal Foundation for the Performing Arts, or KFQSSRFFTPA for short. But like any autocrat, King Friday has his flaws. He's vain, he's insecure, and most of all, he doesn't like to be fooled. And this time, he won't get fooled again. I shall make a rule, he declares. By now, make-believe subjects know the drill. King Friday forbids whatever foils his moods and whims. Over the years, he's outlawed harmonicas, bare hands, bad feelings, play, and puppets who don't like him, all with varying degrees of success. Friday's decrees are almost always short-lived. Usually, he changes his mind or simply forgets as he tends to other kingly concerns. In this scene, though, he makes a rule so egregious, so contrary to the nature of make-believe, that to follow it would threaten the neighborhood itself. Not only would it stilt make-believe's progress and dim its denizens' futures, it would drain the joy out of life and make learning impossible, condemning the neighborhood to stagnation, decay, and the slow-moving horrors of indifference. But in a moment of humiliation and short-sightedness, King Friday the 13th issues an edict anyway. Cancel all curiosity. This scene, scripted by and starring Fred Rogers in a late-stage turn-of-the-millennium episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, is more than just make-believe. Kicking off a five-part series about curiosity, the image of a king trying to suppress his people's questions has roots in real life. Throughout history, countless rulers have sought to cancel curiosity themselves. As any tyrant knows, the less inquisitive a society is, the less free it becomes. In 1937, the Nazis staged the infamous Degenerate Art Exhibition, where more than 700 works of modern art were defaced and ridiculed. Actors, posing as critics, wandered through the crowds, loudly proclaiming that modern art, a style that invites interpretation by provoking questions, was not art at all, but rather a product of mental illness and Jewish perversion. As a result, many of the exhibition's attendees left less willing to question how the Nazis treated their neighbors. It's a tactic that's been used for centuries. During China's Cultural Revolution, militants destroyed libraries to eradicate opposing ideas. In the United States, schools were first burned and bombed, then segregated and budget-starved to prevent Black children from learning. In the antebellum South, enslaved people caught with books were beaten or killed. Campaigns to cancel curiosity stretch all the way back to antiquity. Consider the cautionary tale of ancient Greeks succumbing to the sirens, or Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden dooming mankind by tasting the forbidden fruit. or Lot and his family fleeing the biblical city of Sodom, forbidden by God to look back, when Lot's wife gives her into her curiosity and sneaks a final glance, she's transformed into a pillar of salt. To ask questions of the universe and then learn to live with those questions is the way one achieves his own identity, said the writer James Baldwin. But no society is really anxious to have that kind of person around. What societies really, ideally want is a citizenry which will simply obey the rules of society. Perhaps it's no wonder, then, that some of our oldest stories and sayings suggest ambivalence or even outright hostility towards the inquisitive. Curiosity leads to exploration. Exploration leads to questions, and questions threaten the status quo. Curiosity is power. And when that power is cultivated, it can change lives, topple dictators, and even reshape the planet. Hundreds of thousands of years ago, for example, one of humanity's predecessors had a question. Homo erectus wouldn't have called it that. The invention of words was still a long way off. But somewhere on the African savanna, or in a cave on the Sinai Peninsula, a mystery appeared. What might happen, our ancestors wondered, if I picked up those rocks over there and bashed them together? Thus began one of the most important experiments of all time. According to one theory, the discovery of fire gave way to cooking and better nutrition, which led to the doubling of hominid neurons. Equipped with unprecedented brain power, humans grew more and more sophisticated, learning to talk to one another, to build societies and cities, and to spread out across the globe. They developed ideas that the Earth is 6,000 years old, or that cavities are caused by tiny worms in our teeth, and replace those ideas with better ones through science. They invented music, medicine, and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. They even left the planet, launching a Martian rover that, perhaps out of gratitude, they called Curiosity. Best of all, our predecessors passed this power to us. Nearly every human being is born curious. Babies as young as 9 weeks old tend to focus on what's new and unfamiliar rather than what's constant or routine. Before they learn to speak, they learn to point. A baby's way of saying, "Tell me," is to point to an object while looking at her mother, writes Ian Leslie, author of Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Future Depends on It. As toddlers, kids become dogged investigators, asking why at every opportunity. Curiosity is so ubiquitous, so fundamental to who we are as a species, that psychologists put it on par with the drive to eat, sleep, and reproduce. Not only is it the linchpin of intellectual achievement, as one scientist puts it, evidence suggests that curiosity will only grow more essential in coming decades. But there's a catch. Almost all of us are born curious. Far fewer actually stay that way. Curiosity can fade shockingly fast. Disparities emerge even among babies, growing wider over time. It doesn't take a tyrant to cancel curiosity. Even the most well-meaning adult can dim a child's desire to know. If curiosity isn't nurtured, it tends to be transitory, to die out or to wane its intensity, writes the philosopher John Dewey in 1910. In a few people, intellectual curiosity is so insatiable that nothing will discourage it, but in most, its edge is easily dulled and blunted. That's a problem, especially today. It's been estimated that today's young people could change jobs as many as 15 times over the course of their lifetimes, and that many of their jobs will require work that hasn't yet been invented. The future will require today's young people to forge careers that cross sectors and industries requiring constant learning. Those without the ability or desire to keep up could find themselves automated out of a job or otherwise left behind. Meanwhile, the curious will be rewarded. It's already happening. Consider the priorities of any number of leaders and intellectuals. Apple CEO Tim Cook seeks employees with obsessive curiosity. Addressing a crowd of college graduates, Oprah Winfrey said this, "I wish you curiosity." Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, when asked about their success, both credited their desire to learn more about the world. And Ta-Nehisi Coates, the National Book Award-winning writer, has described himself as irrepressible in terms of my curiosities. The list goes on, but curiosity's value extends beyond wealth or professional success. Curious people can question their circumstances and fight for something better. They can appreciate the world's marvels and the importance of conservation. Above all, curious people are learners, people who can look closely at an orange blossom or a mural or a fellow human being and wonder. What curiosity can do. Did you know, Fred Rogers used to sing, did you know when you wonder, you're learning? Throughout the neighborhood's 31-season run, Rogers served as Curiosity's most famous televangelist, nurturing children's inquisitiveness in ways that, when viewed from today's world of pinging phones and breaking news, can seem almost quaint. Pick any episode at random, and you might find Rogers exploring a pinwheel, or carefully drawing a rainbow, or narrating a documentary about citrus fruits. He makes a point again and again of telling viewers how many questions he has and how much he wants to know about the world. He's so genuinely interested in everything that viewers can't help but to be interested too. And when he looks at the camera and asks if you've ever wondered about how people make crayons or if you've yearned to visit an eraser factory, you surprise yourself by how quickly you think yes. Thinkers, teachers, and scientists have long been interested in the power of wonder. From Jean Piaget to B.F. Skinner, psychologists have probed curiosity's origins. Today, behavior scientists and neuroscientists are shedding new light on its functions. But even before the advent of modern learning science, Rogers seemed to sense that curiosity drives learning, a thesis that brain scans and studies are now confirming in droves. Consider these lines from Did You Know, a song Rogers debuted in 1979. Did you know, did you know, did you know that it's all right to wonder? There are all kinds of wonderful things. You can ask a lot of questions about the world and your place in it. You can ask about people's feelings. You can learn the sky's the limit. Did you know, did you know, did you know when you wonder, you're learning? Did you know when you marvel, you're learning? All about all kinds of wonderful, all kinds of marvelous, marvelously wonderful things. Like so much of Fred Rogers' work, Did You Know was inspired by his childhood. Fred McFeely, his maternal grandfather, was wonderfully supportive of Fred's sense of curiosity, his sense of learning, and his sense of exploration, says Maxwell King, author of The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. Fred McFeely understood that the most natural thing in the world for a child is to be exploring and learning and wondering about how the world works and how one fits in. When Rogers was young, for example, he was curious about where kittens came from. While questions about reproduction sometimes strike fear in the hearts of parents, Fred McFeely had an idea. He let little Freddie watch a cat give birth. The experience satisfied Rogers' curiosity in a developmentally appropriate way with a trusted adult, his grandfather, serving as a guide. I'll always remember that as a wonderful time, Rogers later said. My grandfather helped me to understand it so well, and he told me, you know, Freddie, it's all right to wonder about things and ask about things. Watching a cat give birth might seem like a strange thing to remember several decades after the fact. It might seem odder still that Rogers would show his viewers another cat doing exactly the same thing. But the reality is that this is stuff kids wonder about. And according to learning scientists, Rogers was right. When kids wonder, they are learning, or at least they're far more likely to. Inciting children's curiosity is the best way to ensure that they will absorb and retain information, writes psychologist Susan Engel, one of the world's leading experts on curiosity's development. In 2009, a team of Caltech researchers demonstrated this by posing a series of trivia questions to a group of volunteers. They asked participants to guess the answers to the questions and rate their level of curiosity about each. That is, to tell the researchers how much they wanted to know the answer. Later, the volunteers were shown each question again, followed by the correct response. The research team watched their brains light up via functional magnetic resonance imaging. In effect, watching the volunteer's brain process information in real time. They found that when volunteers were curious, their brains indicated the type of feelings you have before the curtain goes up on a play you've wanted to see for a long time, writes author Mario Livio. The researchers also found that when the correct answer was revealed to the subjects, the regions of the brain that were significantly energized were those typically associated with learning, memory, and language comprehension and production. In other words, the more curiosity that participants reported feeling, the more they wondered, the more powerfully their brains were primed for learning. On the other hand, this might not surprise you. Anyone who has ever struggled to stay awake during a boring presentation knows how difficult it can be to learn information that doesn't pique your interest. On the other hand, the Caltech study allowed scientists to measure just how much difference curiosity can make. 10 days later, when asked to recall what they learned, participants more easily answered the questions they'd been curious about. This helped explain why Rogers never forgot watching the births of those kittens. A later study from the University of California at Davis found an even more surprising benefit. When participants were highly curious about the information in front of them, they also more easily learned other information, even when it was unrelated. As one researcher put it, curiosity may put the brain in a state that allows it to learn and return any kind of information, like a vortex that sucks in what you are motivated to learn and also everything around it. When you wonder, you're learning, indeed. Such findings should be great news for parents, teachers, and anyone else concerned with children's learning. Since kids are naturally curious, harnessing their desire to ask and answer questions should be a no-brainer. Now that we know just how powerful curiosity can be, we'd expect learning environments to be like little laboratories, places where it's all right to wonder, where kids explore the what's and how's and why's of the problems that intrigue them, and where their brains light up day in and day out, making schools and libraries and museums the most joyful places on the planet. And in a few lucky places, that's exactly what's happening. At the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh, Jason Brown stands beneath a towering room-sized replica of the human brain, full of twinkling lights that map the constellations of neurons that carry our thoughts and feelings. All around him, the center's 3-foot visitors dart from exhibit to exhibit, their parents struggling to keep up. One presses a button that says, "Why do I fart?" letting out a long recording of human flatulence. Shrieks of discovery and delight ring throughout the building. "Sometimes we forget that learning is supposed to be fun," says Brown. "It's something the center's director knows from experience. As a kid, he had no particular love for science. I remember doing formulas for reactions of acids and bases in schools, and never once did I think, 'Wow, this is amazing,' he says. It wasn't until he mixed ammonia and Drano at home, a mixture that exploded in his driveway, that he developed an interest. 'I think I just needed to see some destruction,' he says, laughing. 'After that, I was hooked.'" Brown's curiosity had simply needed to be captured, priming his brain for learning. Today, the center he leads offers kids and families a similar and safer chance to feel what he felt in his childhood driveway. Everything here is designed to do such priming. There's a theater for live liquid nitrogen demonstrations, a million-volt Tesla coil for making lightning, display boxes full of fake animal poop, and the air hockey bot, a computerized arm that calculates a puck's location and speed at 100 times per second, making it virtually unbeatable to human opponents. "In my 5 years of working here," laments Brown, "I've won only once." Walking through the center, it's impossible not to gape at such things in astonishment, and that's exactly the point. When children are captivated, they start asking questions, and the more questions they ask, the more they're likely to learn. For adults, the key is to keep encouraging such wonder. "As a society, I think we've gotten too used to just giving kids the answers," said Brown. Sometimes the best answer isn't an answer at all. Instead of telling them X happens because Y, it's often better to ask, why do you think X happens? Have you ever seen anything like that before? What happens if you press that button? What else does this make you wonder about? Of course, families don't have to visit a science center to find something that stokes curiosity. Tesla coils are cool, but so are bugs and flowers and cardboard tubes. Given ample opportunities and encouragement, kids will ask questions about just about anything. As psychologist Michelle Chouinard and her colleagues demonstrated by analyzing some 230 hours of recorded conversations between four children and their respective caregivers. The children had been recorded at regular intervals from the time they were 14 months old until they were just over 5 years old. Chouinard's team wanted to find out how asking questions can aid a child's development. What kinds of questions do children ask? What do they want to know about? And what do they do with the answers they get? The kids asked a lot of questions, more than 100 per hour on average. They span several topics and range from simple information gathering, what is this, to more abstract explorations, why would someone do that? Chouinard concluded that curiosity is a central part of what it means to be a child. Adults, however, don't always treat it as such. When Susan Engel went searching for curiosity in elementary school classrooms, she found the opposite of what Chouinard and her team had encountered. For the most part, kindergartners asked very few questions and spent little time investigating the environment. In any given 2 hour stretch, we'd see anywhere from 2 to 5 questions or explorations, Engel recounts. In fifth grade classrooms, the situation was even more striking. A typical 2 hour stretch of time didn't yield even one student question. That means 11-year-olds often go for hours at a time in school without indicating anything they want to know about. Though Chouinard and Engel studied different populations in different places, their diverging results suggest that, hypothetically, the same child who asks 2 questions per minute at home might hear fewer than 2 questions per hour in class. Engel notes that even in the livelier classroom she observed, genuine wonder was usually absent. In most cases, kids had followed clear-cut directions towards a predetermined objective. Of course, there are plenty of good reasons to limit children's inquiry. Curiosity is a powerful driver of learning, but it's not without drawbacks. For one, the sort of total curiosity that most of us are born with, the kind that makes us grasp our toys, stick them in our mouths, and hurl them across rooms, is essential to our early explorations of the world. But as we age, this kind of curiosity can become a liability. Imagine trying to work when any sort of novelty, a new car outside the window, a new colleague down the hall, sparks an all-consuming fascination. No one would get anything done. Nor would anyone learn much because every new thing would drag our focus from the last. If you've ever looked up from your Twitter feed only to find that several hours have passed, you have a sense of what this feels like. Likewise, curiosity's age-old association with danger, think Lot's wife or the old saying about curiosity killing the cat, isn't entirely without merit. There's a reason childproofing is a billion-dollar industry. Kids have a knack for putting themselves in peril when they want to know something, whether it's what's behind that electrical outlet or how deep that swimming pool might be. Curiosity is why we have toilet locks and childproof pill bottles. It's why professional childproofers can charge thousands of dollars to assess private homes and sell solutions to nervous parents. And it's why Greg's daughter, wondering what her house would look like from a second-story balcony, once scaled a safety gate and climbed over a railing before she even learned to walk. Fortunately, despite her expert ascent, her parents managed to pull her back to safety. But it's doubtful that these reasons alone account for the yawning curiosity gaps that Engel found in classrooms. In many learning environments, there's a disconnect between what kids naturally do, ask questions that interest them, and what they actually do, work within the confines of an adult's plan. There's a disconnect, too, between what kids want to know, how kittens are born, and what we as adults want them to learn, how fractions reduce. Engel recalls one particular ironic back and forth. In one classroom I observed, a ninth grader raised her hand to ask if there were any places in the world where no one made art. The teacher stopped her mid-sentence with, "Zoe, no questions now, please. It's time for learning." The truth is that we can wind up chastening children's curiosity when we're actually trying to channel it. How many of us have come home exhausted after a long day only to shortchange, redirect, or otherwise ignore a child's inquiries? In the moment, it's sometimes easier to say, "I don't know," or "ask your mother," or even, "where's your iPad?" But over time, our cues can signal that we neither value nor encourage children's questions. Curiosity is so fragile, in fact, that we cancel it without even speaking. As mentioned earlier, when babies want to know about something, they point to it, but they'll only continue to do so if their pointing results in answers. Moreover, those answers have to be good answers. In one study, researchers found that when incompetent or inattentive adults give bad information, babies become less likely to point. It's sobering to think that even at such an early age, infants are capable of telling whether or not you're an idiot, writes Leslie. Other cues can be even subtler. Research has shown that kids are much more likely to explore unfamiliar objects if adults make encouraging faces or otherwise show their interest in the object. In other words, children can catch our curiosity if we model it. If we want to raise curious kids, it helps to be curious ourselves, both visibly and verbally. It's what you bring to the children every day, your listening, your caring, your enthusiasm, and your responding to their ideas, thoughts, and feelings that encourage and inspire children to ask questions and to be imaginative. Rogers wrote to adults, "By responding thoughtfully to children's questions, you're encouraging their curiosity. Even when you don't know the answer, you're letting them know it's good to wonder and ask." Curiosity can be taught and caught. In the 1950s, if you wanted to understand what made children tick, Pittsburgh was the place to be. For a few years, the superstars of child development all worked in the same place, the Arsenal Family and Children's Center, co-founded in 1953 by the rock star pediatrician Dr. Benjamin Spock. Having recently published the Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, Spock was the era's most celebrated authority on childhood. Even today, his book remains a bestseller. As a professor at the University of Pittsburgh, he launched Arsenal as a training site for students studying child development. His colleague at the center, the German-American psychologist Erik Erikson, had just published a landmark book of his own, which he introduced the world to the concept of identity crisis, among other things. The presence of Spock and Erikson alone would have been enough to cement the center's legacy. To study child development at Arsenal would have been akin to studying music with Beethoven and Bach. But a third colleague, one who's lesser known to the world but is every bit as influential, is the reason the lessons learned at Arsenal would eventually impact millions of children beyond the center's tiny brick building in Pittsburgh. Margaret McFarlane knew more than anyone in this world about families with young children, Erikson used to say. A child psychologist, educator, and professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, Dr. Margaret McFarlane taught kindergartners in Melbourne and college students in Massachusetts before returning to her hometown to co-found Arsenal. It was there that one day a young man from the nearby theological seminary came knocking at her door. The budding minister, named Fred Rogers, had decided that he wanted to work with children through television. His teachers at the seminary, however, weren't entirely sure what to do with such a request. Nothing like that had ever been fashioned from Presbyterian fabric, notes Maxwell King. Eventually, a professor suggested that Rogers contact McFarlane to study child development under her guidance. The suggestion led to a lifelong friendship and professional collaboration that would eventually shape whole generations of kids. Rogers studied with McFarlane for years at Arsenal. Later, he met with her each week to discuss scripts and songs for the neighborhood. As Rogers' mentor, McFarlane left an indelible mark on the program. "To know and love Fred Rogers," one journalist wrote, "is to know and love Margaret McFarlane." Rogers often said that one of the most profound lessons he learned from McFarland was the Quaker idea that attitudes are caught, not taught. He recalled how McFarland had once invited a famous sculptor to Arsenal. Dr. McFarland said to him, "I don't want you to teach sculpting. All I want you to do is to love clay in front of the children." And that's what he did. He came once a week for a whole term, sat with the 4 and 5 year olds as they played, and he loved his clay in front of them. The directive worked. The adults who worked at Arsenal for years said that neither before nor since had the children there used clay so imaginatively, Rogers recalled. By simply delighting in his work, the sculptor had made children wonder about clay and what they might do with it themselves. They caught his curiosity. Nearly every episode of The Neighborhood followed this lead in one way or another. Rogers introduced kids to diverse TV neighborhoods who were passionate about any number of crafts and occupations. There was Yo-Yo Ma loving the cello, Wynton Marsalis loving the trumpet, Bill Nye loving science, Julia Child loving recipes, LeVar Burton loving books. The best teachers in the world is the one who loves what he or she does and just loves it in front of you, he said, echoing McFarland. And that's what I like to do with the neighborhood. I love to have guests and presenters in a whole smorgasbord of ways for the children to choose. Some child might choose painting, some child might choose playing the cello, but there are so many ways of saying who we are and how we feel. In this very first nationally broadcast episode, Rogers visits Mrs. Russell Light, an eccentric neighbor who collects lampshades. Rather than judging her choice of hobby, Rogers indulges it. He shows genuine interest in her collection and even puts a lampshade on his head. Throughout the rest of the series, Rogers unrelentingly exposes viewers to adults who wonder and who assure children that their questions have value. For parents, the program reinforces McFarland's message to the sculptor. Love learning in front of your kids. Let them catch your curiosity. Listen to their questions, learn their interests, and let them lead the journey towards knowledge. Trusting kids to be curious is a crucial first step in that journey, a step we've collectively learned to skip in a culture that prizes efficiency over exploration and mastery over inquiry. Consider, for example, a simple button, the kind one might find on a cardigan sweater. Imagine sitting at a desk with nothing before you except that button. What's your first reaction? A lot of adults will immediately say, "Oh, now what? What am I supposed to do with this button?" They'll assume they're supposed to make something or have some sort of next step, says Melissa Butler, a nationally acclaimed educator, consultant, and writer. And despite all the research that's out there about children's curiosity and how many questions kids ask, we often assume that children are the same way. We assume they find the button boring. As founder of the Reimagining Project LLC and director of the Children's Innovation Project, Butler believes differently. Because buttons are so basic, she says, kids can bring their full selves to them. Children who haven't been granted access to a particular experience or certain prior knowledge aren't prevented from engaging with such a simple object. In fact, kids don't have to know anything other than who they are in order to engage fully in something like a button, she says. And eventually, given enough time and encouragement, children will start to notice things about the button and they'll want to find out more. Oh, you found a bump? You found a tiny scratch? I wonder what else you can find, says Butler. Setting limits on materials and focusing on one small thing allows children to really slow down. They notice what's there, what's not there, what might have been there before, and what might be dreamed of. Too often, we don't allow questions to emerge from what children are interested in. If we would just do that and listen, then their curiosity evolves. Butler has focused on a slow, simple approach to teaching and learning for more than 2 decades, an approach Rogers himself emphasized on his program. The more space we can give children to not know, to not make a finished project, to not be done, the more space we allow for curiosity that's internalized and intrinsically motivated, she says, because that's what learning is. It's constantly wondering. It's keeping yourself in a perpetual state of not knowing. Susan Engel and her graduate student, Madeline Labella, demonstrated this in a particularly striking experiment. They brought 8 and 9 year olds into a lab to do a science project called Bouncing Raisins, which required kids to drop raisins into a concoction of ingredients. With one group of children, Labella stopped partway through the project and said, "You know what? I wonder what would happen if we dropped a Skittle in the liquid instead of a raisin." With the other group, Labella and the children completed the project without straying from its instructions. Labella then left both groups alone in their respective rooms, telling them they could do whatever they wanted while she was gone. Sure enough, the kids who had seen Labella deviate from the task continued to experiment in her absence, dropping more objects into the liquid to see what might happen. The children who completed the project as instructed tended to do nothing at all. Not only did this experiment reinforce the importance of modeling and allowing curiosity, it suggested a powerful way to pique children's interests. Scientists have found that something irresistible happens when we mix the familiar, raisins and Skittles, with the unknown, what happens when they're dropped into liquid. Ian Leslie notes that when people are presented with different landscape images, they tend to prefer those that include water, perhaps the most familiar substance on Earth. But what's really interesting is that the most consistent and universal predicator of preference in these studies is mystery, scenes that hint at something we cannot see, he writes. The reassuring presence of something we know is good for us, gives us pleasure. But so does the promise of what lies beyond, the information we don't yet know. In other words, we feel most curious when we're aware of a gap between what we're familiar with and what we want to know. It's hard to feel curious about something we don't know. It's hard to feel curious about something we know absolutely nothing about. Take, for example, the term clinical lycanthropy. If it doesn't ring any bells for you, then it probably doesn't sound all that intriguing. But what if you learned that clinical lycanthropy is a psychiatric disorder and an exceedingly rare one at that? Then you would be inclined to pursue a few details. You become aware of what you don't know. Then discovering that it refers to people who believe they've turned into cows or wolves, the term becomes more intriguing still. The more you know, the more you want to know. Under the right conditions, you're driven to learn all you can until you perceive yourself as an expert, at which point curiosity begins to wane. This framework for curiosity, known as the information gap theory, was developed by George Lowenstein, the great-grandson of a famed psychologist, Sigmund Freud, and a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, just next door to where Rogers filmed his program. Lowenstein's theory suggests that children need to have some basic knowledge about a subject before they can develop a sustained interest in it. That's why Rogers spent so much time exploring whatever happens to be in his TV living room, says Roberta Schomburg, a longtime consultant for Fred Rogers Productions, who now directs the Fred Rogers Center at St. Vincent College in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. What always intrigues me is the way that he found something deep in the little familiar things that surround us every day, she says. He likes to look carefully and discover something new in whatever was already part of the environment, like his fish tank. He didn't expect children to be curious about something they knew nothing about. Instead, he trusted them to notice something new about things that were already there. Rogers knew that for kids to learn effectively, the information at hand had to connect to what they're familiar with and what they want to know more about. It has to strike that tantalizing balance between familiarity and mystery, the very balance on which the neighborhood was built. Curiosity's components. Once upon a time, writes journalist Tom Junod, Fred Rogers took off his jacket and put on a sweater his mother had made him, a cardigan with a zipper. Then he took off his shoes and put on a pair of navy blue canvas boating sneakers. He did the same thing the next day and then the next until he had done the same things, those things, 865 times at the beginning of 865 television programs over a span of 31 years. Indeed, the basic format of the neighborhood changed so little throughout the decades that the program's famous first frames spark a sort of Pavlovian response among the program's viewers. When Rogers visits Coco, a 28-year-old who's grown up watching the neighborhood, the first thing she did was take off his shoes for him, a gesture that might have been unremarkable if not for the fact that Coco was a 280-pound gorilla. Even Coco understood Roger's routine. Though viewers don't know the specific of what's to come in any particular episode, they know the general outline. Rogers will show them around his house or his neighborhood for a while before the trolley takes them to make believe. Afterwards, the trolley brings viewers back to the real world, where Rogers unpacks what they've seen. Then he sings his departure song and anticipates the next episode. I'll be back when the day is new, and I'll have more ideas for you. Given the immense innovations that arose in both television programming and the world at large during the neighborhood's multi-decade run, Rogers' adherence to the same basic format might seem old-fashioned or out of touch. After all, those same decades saw the debut of both the Atari and the PlayStation 2, of cordless phones and the internet. But Rogers knew that without familiarity, and by extension, the trust that familiarity fosters, children's curiosity can wither. It sounds counterintuitive, but children's sense of adventurousness is paradoxically tied to their sense of safety. Kids need both to feel confident enough to explore the world around them. Learning science has shown this again and again. In the 1970s, researcher Mary Ainsworth and Sylvia Bell at Johns Hopkins University recruited 56 one-year-olds and their mothers for a series of experiments. First, they placed a mother and her child in a room with some toys, which the one-year-old would then explore. Then they asked the mother to leave the room, recording how the child reacted to the separation. Then when the mother returned, they observed how the child reacted and what the child did next. The researchers found that kids with a secure attachment to their mothers, that is, kids who felt confident in their enduring relationship, greeted their mothers warmly before turning back to the toys. Others, however, clung to their mothers and refused to resume exploring, suggesting that their fear of abandonment overrode their curiosity. Leslie sums this up in a decidedly Rogers-like way. The more we love home, the more we are likely to strike out, she says. Curiosity is underwritten by love. A few years later, scientists showed this another way, this time by placing rats on a raised platform with several extended walkways. One of the walkways had no sides. Imagine a pedestrian bridge with no railings. When left to roam the platform, the rats mostly explored the enclosed walkways, perceiving them as safer. But when researchers injected them with anti-anxiety drugs, the rats explored the open walkway too. The implication is that fear had dampened their desire to explore the unknown. When that fear accumulates over time, whether due to trauma, an unsafe environment, or the absence of caring adults, it can damage children's drive to explore the wider world. Curiosity is power, yes, but it's also a privilege, one extended to kids whose basic survival needs have already been met. If kids are hungry or hurting or scared, they're less likely to have the luxury of wondering. This is one of the many factors that puts kids from poverty at a disadvantage. They're often forced to devote precious cognitive resources to things that their more affluent peers take for granted. Some kids are more likely to wonder where their next meal is coming from, rather than what a meteor is made of. To the extent that he could, Rogers designed the neighborhood as a safe haven in which every child could feel secure. In 1969, during his now famous testimony before the Senate Subcommittee on Communications, Rogers explained his mission. I give an expression of care every day to each child. The routine he established on his show were an expression of that care. Hedda Bluestone Sharapan joined the neighborhood as an assistant director on the first day of production in 1966, later serving as an associate producer and director of early childhood initiatives at Fred Rogers Productions. Today, she's a senior fellow at the Fred Rogers Center and a child development consultant for Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. Rogers, Sharapan explains, wanted to emphasize clear expectations. We're not going to surprise you, she said, of the neighborhood's philosophy. We're going to tell you where you're going, and we're going to give you an introduction to it, and we're going to take you there. When we come back, we're going to talk about where we've been. You had a sense that the world was trustworthy and predictable. You could relax and be ready to learn. Rogers went beyond establishing safety. He also emphasized warmth right down to his gentle tone in soft sweaters. And rightly so, learning scientists have linked an educator's disposition to the degree of engagement that learners convey. In 2018, for example, a group of researchers studied the effects of greeting middle school students at the classroom door. This seemingly minor gesture yielded stunning benefits. Student engagement increased by 20%, while disruptions decreased by nearly 10%. A simple show of warmth effectively added an extra hour of learning to the school day. Such warmth permeates every aspect of the neighborhood. Fred called each program a television visit, said Sharapan. When you walk into a room as a visitor, what makes you feel safe? The environment has a lot to do with it, how things are set up, whether they convey comfort, and how people are welcoming you with their voice and body language. Consider Roger's unflinching eye gaze. He stares directly into the camera for lengths of time that might seem discomforting to today's adults. To children, however, his gaze mimics that of a supportive parent. His trolley, too, serves as a device ferrying viewers from the living room to the neighborhood of make-believe and back, helping young children to cope with comings and goings, which, as we've seen, helps them relax and feel comfortable enough to be curious. Once familiarity, and with it, a sense of safety and warmth has been established, Rogers adds curiosity's other ingredient, mystery. This is where the fun begins. The neighborhood makes viewers feel safe, to be sure, but safety was a prerequisite, not the main event. What drew kids to the neighborhood was something else entirely, the knowledge that such a program could, as children's author E.B. White once put it, arouse our dreams, satisfy our hunger for beauty, take us on journeys, enable us to participate in events, present great drama and music, and explore the sea and the sky and the woods and the hills. The neighborhood delivered. The bulk of the program's seasons are organized around theme weeks that cover a lot of ground. There's a week for divorce, love, mad feelings, secrets, and curiosity, just to name a few. Over the course of a single week in February 2000, Mr. Rogers talks about curiosity. Rogers visits a vegetable garden, takes a ride in a bucket lift, puts on an astronaut costume, and builds a musical instrument. Each episode taps two proven catalysts for creating mystery, what Engel called the invisible and the exotic. The purple pandas that appear throughout the week are perfect examples. They're visitors from a faraway planet who can literally disappear. No wonder Rogers deploys them as curiosity's agents. The neighborhood also piqued curiosity through art. Though it's tempting to dismiss stories and songs and drawings as diversions or add-ons, things kids do after the real work of learning, Rogers took the opposite track. In the neighborhood, the arts weren't extracurricular, they're curiosity's very foundation. The artistry of the program, McFarlane once wrote, stimulates the children's interest in the world around them and fosters their learning. Here again, learning science has proven Rogers right. Arts experience have been shown to feed curiosity by teaching kids to be careful, thorough observers of the world. Kids who study the arts may become stronger critical thinkers with better life outcomes. According to one nationally representative study, each year of arts study correlates with a 20% reduction in the likelihood of an adolescent suspended from school. Young people who've studied the arts are almost 30% more likely to hold a four-year college degree by early adulthood and 26% less likely to get arrested. And while it's unclear whether the arts boost academic outcomes, at least as measured by test scores, evidence suggests that in the long run, exposing kids to the arts can significantly improve their lives. The arts capture children's interests in ways that bare-bones information simply can't. Consider a time-honored tradition found in classrooms across the world, the textbook. Textbooks have been helping definitions, rules, and facts for more than 1,000 years, and for good reason. As vessels for vast amounts of specialized information, textbooks are unbeatable, especially in classrooms where resources are scant or teachers are untrained. But in the era of mass production, successful textbooks have to appeal to the broadest possible market. That means publishers have almost universally dropped art and style in favor of more straightforward presentation of material, creating the blandness with which we're all too familiar. However, a number of studies have found that kids actually learn better counter the opposite, stylized, even complicated texts that deploy seductive details and jump down rabbit holes to make their points. This makes intuitive sense in light of popular nonfiction titles. When adults want to learn about complicated esoteric topics, they tend to seek out texts that satisfy their curiosity in an entertaining way. Most of us wouldn't rush to Amazon for the latest textbook on advanced forestry. Yet Peter Walburn's The Hidden Life of Trees, which reveals the science behind arboreal communication, topped nonfiction list for weeks. With arts comes nuance, idiosyncrasy, and some degree of difficulty. This too is beneficial, learning scientists say. A number of studies suggest that the harder we work to acquire information, the more thoroughly we ultimately understand it. Presenting that information through art, as Rogers did, is one way to induce difficulty without diminishing curiosity or enjoyment. Researchers have found that even something as simple as printing materials in hard-to-read fonts can help students retain knowledge. Inducing difficulty also leads learners to make mistakes, which, when paired with corrective feedback, has been shown to deepen learning as well. But the arts do more than nurture curiosity about content. They also provoke questions about other people. The arts, after all, are a form of storytelling, and humans are naturally drawn to stories, especially those that concern other humans. Studies have shown that kids as young as 4 years old prefer stories about people or people-like characters to stories about animals or inanimate objects. They also crave stories about groups of people rather than individuals, perhaps because they're curious about the many ways people can interact with each other. No wonder, then, that the neighborhood of make-believe thrilled so many children. Populated by humans and human-like puppets with distinct personalities, make-believe offered several protagonists with which kids could identify. The stubborn ruler, King Friday the 13th, the curious Prince Tuesday, the anxious Henrietta Pussycat, the mischievous Lady Elaine, and the timid Daniel Striped Tiger, among many others. When children identify with fictional characters, they share in those characters' feelings, vicariously experiencing joys and struggles from a safe vantage point. Precisely because fiction is make-believe and has no immediate real-world consequences, writes psychologist Peter Gray, children can experience the challenges and difficulties more clearly, thinking about them more rationally, and develop more insights about them than we might from real-world experiences. And it's through this process that kids learn to empathize with people who are different from themselves. We'll talk more about empathy later on, but for now, it's enough to know that stories help kids try to imagine themselves in one another's shoes. And the ability to do that is at least as important as what a child knows. That's the premise of the Saturday Light Brigade, a nationally broadcast public radio program that airs documentaries, interviews, and live performances created by kids. Shanisa Schuler runs the program Crossing Fences series, in which Black boys interview Black men in their communities to create short, professionally produced oral histories. While Schuler helps them workshop their potential interview questions, kids are free to pursue the lines of inquiry that interest them most. Some of them want to ask questions like, "If you were a superhero, which one would you be?" She says, laughing. But when they're asking about things they truly want to know, they elicit some really amazing answers. The men the kids interview for Crossing Fences are community leaders, and the opportunity to sit with them and ask honest questions helps kids relate to them in a more human level, says Schuler. Say you're interviewing your high school teacher, she says. Now you're back in the classroom and things have changed. You know your teacher as a person, so how is your interaction going to be different from here on out? You're going to see him as a whole new light. You can relate to him, and when kids relate to adults, they're far more likely to learn from them. Though the Saturday Night Light Brigade teaches the art and craft of radio production, we're not a media training shop, says Larry Berger, the program's founder and president. We're not trying to create journalists necessarily, we're just trying to create complete people. The key, he says, is giving kids permission to be curious and providing the tools and a platform for expressing that curiosity. As kids get older, it can be hard for them to admit what they don't know. And if they're even a little scared of being perceived as ignorant, they'll refrain from asking questions. But if we train them, if we give them reporters' notebooks and explain that we want them to do a story so that other people can understand it, suddenly we've given them permission to ask anything in the world, says Berger. It's kind of liberation. Experts say there's deep value in creating spaces like this where kids can ask honest, respectful questions of one another. The Reverend Paula Lawrence Wellmiller, an educator who helped advise the neighborhood, argues that much of the world's prejudice, for example, results from stifled curiosity, or as she puts it, our inability to expose our ignorance about each other. We don't like to be fooled, and so we sometimes hide our not knowing by resorting to assumptions and stereotypes and biases. We might even try to cancel curiosity ourselves. But the neighborhood teaches the opposite. It is in the context of a truthful relationship with children, writes Reverend Lawrence Waymiller, that Fred Rogers encourages children to ask questions, to be in the habit of unburdening themselves of hurtful ignorance. He creates a sanctuary for children, a place where they feel safe to be themselves, to express their wonderings and fears, or even to be allowed to be shy about them. This is epitomized in what is today among the neighborhood's most famous scenes. On February 18, 1981, Rogers introduced viewers to Jeffrey Erlinger, a young boy from Madison who'd been diagnosed with a spinal tumor when he was just 7 months old. Erlinger's resulting surgeries had left him without use of his arms and legs, and when he appeared on the neighborhood at age 10, he arrived at the front of Rogers' television house in an electric wheelchair. As the scene unfolds, Roger spends several minutes asking Erlinger the same questions that any child might want to ask. Would you show me how you make your wheelchair go? Did it take you a long time to learn how to use it? Can you tell my friends what it is that made you need this wheelchair? What do you do when you feel blue? Erlinger answers each question earnestly, and Rogers praises him for speaking so freely about his challenges. Then, in an unforgettable duet, Erlinger joins in as Rogers sings, "It's You I Like," a song that begins with its poignant verse. "It's you I like, it's not the things you wear, it's not the way you do your hair, but it's you I like, the way you are right now, the way deep down inside you. Not the things that hide you, not your fancy chair. That's just beside you. It's you I like." This was Rogers turning curiosity into empathy before viewers' very eyes. By asking honest questions in a safe, supportive space, a sanctuary, Rogers showed children and adults alike how curiosity can help us understand and celebrate each other's differences. The scene also taught Erlinger something about himself. He became a community activist in Wisconsin until his death in 2007, committing himself to improving the lives of others. At its best, the neighborhood taught viewers that curiosity can resolve the uncertainties and mysteries that hold us back as human beings. And that, readers, brings us back to where we began. It's dark now in the neighborhood of make-believe, but King Friday the 13th hasn't fallen asleep. Neither is Queen Sarah, nor X the Owl, nor Henrietta Pussycat. Though curiosity has officially been canceled, the puppets here have been kept awake by a question. Will they ever see their beloved Prince Tuesday again? He's been missing now for who knows how long, having fled his father's ban on knowledge seeking. He's thought to be on AOP, altogether other planet, but the team dispatched so to find him has not yet sent word. And really, could anyone blame the young prince for leaving? Who would want to stay in a place like this, a place without questions, without wonder, without learning? Certainly not someone as curious and caring as Prince Tuesday. From his castle balcony, the king looks up at the night sky, purpled by the overhead lights of WQED's Studio A. Perhaps he'd been wrong to cancel his subject's curiosity. Curiosity, after all, is part of who they are as puppets. It's how their creator made them. And besides, there are worse things in life than being fooled, worse things like missing your son. Suddenly, there's a flash in the sky, and the rescue team returns from AOP. With them is Prince Tuesday, safe and unharmed. For a moment, the king's anger comes surging back. Do you see what happened with curiosity? He thunders at his son. But the prince is ecstatic. He's seen wonderful distant planets, things he never would have seen had he not set out on his own. And while it's true that he's gotten a little lost, he says he never meant to worry anybody. He just wanted to know what's out there. King Friday, vain and impulsive though he is, stares at his son in the starlight. He has a choice now. He can double down on canceling curiosity, or he can tell Prince Tuesday that it's all right to wonder, and that there are indeed all kinds of wonderful, marvelous, marvelously wonderful things for children like him to learn. And though many things are mysterious in this particular neighborhood, in this case, the right decision is clear. In the wondrous world of make-believe, King Friday decides curiosity will carry the day. What might you do? When kids are in a state of wonder, they're more likely to retain what they see, hear, and experience. Pay attention to what elicits children's curiosity. When their interest is piqued, their brains are primed for learning. When kids ask why the wind blows or why leaves change color in the fall, it's sometimes helpful to ask open-ended questions and if you're not entirely sure of the answer yourself. The process of discovery can be just as important as finding the factually correct answer. Adults and children can launch lines of inquiry together simply by wondering aloud, asking why and what if. What if we put grapes in our pancakes rather than blueberries? Or why do we need to put more air into the soccer ball? Or what's inside of this toy? Once I saw a teacher who had in her classroom something called an ask it basket, said Hedda Sherapin. When the children would ask a question, she would write it down and say, that's a great one to put in the ask it basket. Whether or not you could answer it as the adult, either in that moment or later on, that simple action told children that their question mattered. Kids can catch curiosity, so it's important for them to see adults indulging interests of their own. What makes you curious? What do you love to do and why? If you're not sure, this is a great excuse to re-examine old hobbies, to put out those abandoned paintbrushes, or dust off that old guitar. It's also helpful to verbalize your questions and thoughts. I wonder what would happen if I mix these colors together, or how does this knob change an instrument's sound?